from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. Opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Body and Spirit Show on this lovely, wonderful Wednesday, May the 10th, 2017. Featherlight, namaste to you.
Namaste, namaste, Black Rose.
How are you?
Hello.
Hello. I'm fine.
I'm fine.
That's good.
Namaste to you and namaste to Scotty and all of the listeners tonight here tuned in to the Mind, Body, and Spirit Show tonight. We are going to go back into our relationship abuse series tonight, and we have a guest author, Seven of Life, Veronica P. Loving. Yes, Veronica P. Loving.
Very beautiful woman, too.
Yes, indeed. She has a story to tell, and her story has been chronicled in her memoir, Feeding the Monsters. So she will be here tonight with us to talk about relationship abuse, how it impacts our self-esteem, and how to survive and get out of those abusive relationships. You know, we talked about friendship abuse and elderly abuse. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to your friend about them being abusive? How do you talk to your mate about them being abusive and protect yourself from those entanglements? So I am so looking forward to hearing her come on because, you know, we watch Greenleaf. And on Greenleaf, the young girl, she's a teenager. And so she realized that she was entangled in this abusive relationship. And I was so happy to see in the scene, once she realized that he was abusive, she didn't start arguing with him, and why are you doing that? Oh, okay, whatever.
Right.
I'll take
it.
She just said, okay. Called her friend and told her friend, come get me. Please retrieve me from this idiot.
She said, come get me now.
Come get me now, because I'm not getting ready to be arguing with him.
Mm-hmm.
Asking him what's wrong, what did I do, and all that, because whatever is wrong and whatever I did, this is not the response I desire. So guess what? Bye.
by. So faith is very timely.
Yes, and there have been people, I'm sure, that have experienced abuse and maybe didn't even realize that this is an abusive relationship that I'm in.
Right, right.
So being able to identify the abuse, because some actions you may think are normal. If that's what's normative for you, if that's what you've grown up in, if that's the household, that's the background, the experience, that's what you view on television, that's what you've been told to accept, it can be common. It can be very, very common. So,
Right, and to some people, what the young man said on the show, what the words that he said and the way that he said, they would not think of that as abuse. They would not think of that as a sign of abuse. But he picked up on it right away. They would probably excuse it to say, oh, well, you know, he's just kind of stressed out trying to get this music business together. It's very important to him, and give excuses. But she picked up on it. She picked up on it and calmly.
Red flags.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. That's another thing to bring to awareness. Red flags. Red flags.
Noticing those red flags. So I'm looking forward to her speaking tonight. And you can also find her book on Amazon or at your local bookstore, I'm sure. You can always contact her. Excuse me. Feeding the Monster. Reminds me of that movie title, Sleeping with the Enemy.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, that was...
Sleeping with the Enemy.
And then the other one was Enough. Remember
Enough.
That one?
Enough.
Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
They're very difficult to get away from.
Yes. And Halle Berry was in a movie very similar to that too, I believe. She had to escape
that.
An abusive relationship, I think. I'm not quite sure. I'm almost certain, though. So, our African Spirit honoree tonight is part two of Dr. John Henry Clark, since we did not play the video. So I do want to share that. We want to share that video clip because he's speaking about African spirituality, I think, versus religion. You can always send your mind, body, and spirit letters to us at mindbodyandspiritradioshow@gmail.com. If you have any questions about life or your spiritual journey, love, sex, you know, Featherlight always gives us those amazing tips on tantric sex and extending the sexual encounter and having a spiritual encounter. Oh, okay. So let me try to see if I can maybe speak into this mic a little bit better. Thanks for the light. So tonight we are also going to be the recipient of one of Featherlight's quotes, and I am ready to hear your quote, Featherlight.
You ready for my quote? Okay, this is a little different. Mother, may I?
Mother, may I?
Mother, may I? Does that sound familiar to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Oh, okay, okay. Well, this was a game, okay, back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So this past weekend, I gave an event for children in the neighborhood. Crafts and art, did bottle painting and bead making. By art and games.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was thinking about games that we could play with the children, I thought about the games that we played back in the day, way back in the day. You don't see children play these kind of games. So I thought about Mother May I. Mother Mary. We love this game because there was a person up in front who was in charge in the game, and the object was to be that person, to get to that position. And the trick was you had to ask for permission when the entire game. So the person up front will say something like, Black Rose, and it would be way, 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 way back. Take one giant step and two baby steps. And then you would be so excited, and you'd take that giant step, and then she would say, ah, but she didn't say Mother Maya. Go back. So
go back.
That's how the game went. Yes, go back. Go back. You wouldn't say Mother Maya. And then Scotty may say, you know, he'll say, Scotty, take two hops and one skip and one giant step. And Scotty would say, Mother Maya, and then he'd go on and do his little thing. But no matter how close you got, if you got too excited, and then you were almost within like two arms reach of the person, and then they say, okay, Brother Light, take one hop and two baby steps, and you're like, okay, and then you jump and you say, go back, you didn't see Mother Maya. Somebody else could actually get there before you do, because forgot to say Mother May I. I was thinking about this and I thought, must we as African Americans always ask permission, like children,
permission,
Mother May I.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like the college students that you were talking about in D.C. when we feel the need to come together as a group and do something, protest. And then we feel like we gotta let other people, ask other people if they want to come in and join in the fight. You know, get their permission, get their okay. Are you down with it? You know, it's like way back in the day. And then the cause always gets diluted, of course. You know, you come out unwashed, nothing to show for it. But way back in the day, in this country, some people went over to the motherland and took Africans against their will, enslaved them and treated them like children, no matter how old they were, no matter how old they got, for hundreds of years. A man of 60 had to address a boy 5 as Master James, Master Robbie, or whatever. And our enslaved ancestors were told what to do, when to do it, and for how long. A generation from generation to generation, and some people still want to treat Africans living in America as if they were their children. Mother May I. And sadly, some African Americans still feel this sacred approval and buy-in is required. When something is said to those whose lineage did all those horrible, inhumane things to our ancestors, many African Americans living today feel it must be true. Why would they lie? They're like our parents feel. Sometimes mothers have a difficult time cutting the umbilical cord. She wants to maintain the control as long as possible. Wash the clothes when they're 35 or 40. Prepare the meal. Solve all the problems. Because she feels they're not equipped. And sometimes children have an even harder time letting go of their mother's apron strings. They lack confidence in their ability. They don't know their strength. Since it is usually so much more difficult for the mother to cut the imaginary umbilical cord, it is up to the children to turn loose the apron string. Are we children or are we adults? How you see yourself is how others will see you. Namaste.
Namaste. Namaste.
I am an adult.
And asking permission is asking permission to live your life. That's not something that we should have to experience. In fact, speaking, this is a very, very timely what you're mentioning with this asking permission, because I saw this. I think it was like a post speaking about Liberation Day or Malcolm X Day. Let's just make that Malcolm X Day, May 25th, his birthday, and we don't have to like go through in courts begging and pleading as we did with Dr. King's holiday. Those of you that have time off, schedule that day off and make that your own holiday.
Yeah.
Or do something when you're not working.
Just like that. Yeah. Yes. It doesn't have to get everybody's okay.
No, we don't need approval from everyone. It's just, it's not necessary.
Uh-oh.
Not necessary at all. So thank you for sharing that, Southern Light.
You're more than welcome.
Let's be adults.
Let's be adults.
No, Mother May I, remember that game. Sometimes we would say Mother May I or Captain May I.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. We always said Mother May I. With a little boy or a girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, generation change. If you have not signed up for the Rewardance Grocery Store Program, you should have a look at it, because all you have to do is when you shop at your favorite grocery store, then you just upload your receipt onto this website. And the founder, one of the founders, John McCaskill, was on the show last week and shared this whole new idea with us, this concept. He said he really enjoys helping people, and that's how he came up with this concept. And so you basically can receive rewards for shopping. So have a look at it. I went ahead on to sign up. I do have a grocery store receipt, and I am going to upload it. It only took me like about 4 minutes.
Let me stop you right there. I was waiting for you to finish. I just got an email today. He's made the program even easier. You don't have to send in your receipt anymore. All you have to do is sign up. Sign up, get your, it's still free. Sign up, get your password, your ID name or what have you, and then you put, you know, list your favorite stores again, and then they have a whole list, and every month you can just go in there and choose which coupons that you want. You don't have to send in your grocery ticket anymore.
So once you sign up and reward it,
you can still receive the same benefits.
Okay. Yes. All right. Well, someone is always adding improvements.
Yes. Yes. Let me spell it for everyone. rewardance.com. It's rewarded.
All right. And just say that again one more time.
REWARD as in David, A. And it's nancyce.com.
All right, they should have it now.
Like you get a reward.
Reward. Do we have time for you to give your Reagan and Trump piece?
Oh, yes. Just quick. So I thought about all the hoopla about Trump. And, of course, I'm not ruffled by it, because I lived through other presidents, Reagan, for instance. So I wanted to give a little bit of information for people who are not aware of some of the things that went on while Reagan was active. So what brought this to light is that his son, Mike Reagan, is trying to rewrite history about his father. So someone else put out a rebuttal to that, because in his whatever he wrote up about his father, he said that his father, President Reagan, former President Reagan, was a quote-unquote better friend of blacks than President Obama. So someone said, ha ha, you know, it was like a big laugh. So during the 8 years in the White House, Reagan and his appointees waged a well-documented, highly public war against civil rights leaders, and did everything in their political power to roll back civil rights gains. That war began months before Reagan entered the White House at his infamous presidential kickoff campaign rally in Neshoba, Mississippi in 1980, held virtually a stone's throw from where three civil rights workers were murdered in 1964, Reagan shouted to an all-white crowd, "I believe in states' rights." Everyone should know what that means. He laced that speech and many others during his campaign with racial code words and phrases, blasting welfare, big government, and rampant federal spending. The message was that if elected, he would not only say and do as little as possible to offend the white South, he would work to actively undermine civil rights. Another campaign target was the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which he branded as, quote-unquote, humiliating to the South. The implication was that he would not support an extension of the Voting Rights Act when it came up for renewal in 1982. You notice that every 20 years or so it has come up for renewal. At his first White House press conference, the week after his inauguration, Reagan lashed out at affirmative action programs, telling reporters, "I am old enough to remember when quotas existed in the United States for purposes of discrimination, and I don't want to see that again." The checklist of Reagan anti-civil rights and anti-black initiatives soon grew as thick as a telephone book. The president gutted the Civil Rights Commission, slashed and burned an array of federal-funded job and training programs for blacks, and trashed welfare recipients as queens. You know, he was the first one to dub that phrase. He sacked the federal judiciary with strict constructionist states' rights judges, approved the wave of Justice Department indictments and prosecutions of black elected officials, and dragged his feet on imposing congressionally mandated sanctions on apartheid in South Africa. That he repeatedly mocked civil rights leaders almost goes without saying. Here are a few of his best friends and allies. Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina. Helms was one of Reagan's staunchest allies in the U.S. Senate. Helms had a long history of segregationist and racist politics in North Carolina. When the idea of a Martin Luther King holiday came up, Helms red-baited King. Senator Strom Thurmond, everybody knows him, South Carolina. Dixiecrat-turned Republican who helped Nixon with the original Southern strategy. Sherman was a strong proponent of Reagan's policies. Trent Lockman. Oh, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, Reagan's main ally. Reverend Jerry Falwell, in response to, he was a political activist during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Falwell explicitly opposed civil rights and used Christianity to justify Jim Crow. That was Reagan's main ally. In response to the activity of Martin Luther King, Falwell said that Jim Crow policies were God ordained because blacks were stricken with the biblical curse of Ham, meaning that blacks were meant to be the servants of whites. Urging his flock to buy Krugerrands during the Union of South Africa, he called anti-apartheid activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Bishop Desmond Tutu a quote-unquote phony. The Hearst-Ranson statement in 1974, after Patricia Hearst was kidnapped by the Sudanese Liberation Army, the SLA demanded that the Hearst family provide groceries to poor in minority areas. When the food ransom went to poor and minority communities, then Governor Reagan joked, "It's just too bad we can't have an epidemic of botulism." Everybody knows what botulism is. Before its passage, Reagan opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibited discrimination in public accommodations. This act was a cornerstone of the civil rights legislation that eliminated Jim Crow in the 1960s. A series of embarrassing episodes involved Commissioner William Allen during his 14-month tenure as chair in 1988 and 1989. Allen Allen, he was a Reagan appointee, had been rebuked by the commission for an October 1989 speech titled Blacks, Animals, Homosexuals, and what is a minority? These are just a few of the things that we have already gone through with a president who's very openly against certain groups of people. So that's why I really don't get all that excited about Trump. So, just wanted to share some of that. Oh, one last thing before our guest comes on. He is praised for passing the Martin Luther King holiday bill, but Reagan staunchly opposed this bill, and not as historical people claim, because it was the federal government, whatever, they couldn't afford it. They just said that because they didn't want the people to know what how he really, really felt about it. And in his words, he said he signed it since Congress seemed so, quote unquote, bent on making it a national holiday. And he was very clear about how he felt about King, saying until the end that he was still a communist sympathizer even after he signed that bill. All right. That's my bit on Trump. You can say his name, Trump versus Reagan. So, we got our guest online?
Yes, we do. We have our guest online for the life. So, we'll pick back up on your Trump and Reagan comparison. Thank you so much for sharing that, Satellite. And we want to welcome in Veronica P. Loving, author and motivational speaker. She's also an advocate for those that are victims of sexual assault and abusive relationships. Have you been abused in any type of relationship? We have been having our series on relationship abuse. We spoke about elderly abuse and friendship abuse, friends that are abusive to you, and you may not even realize that they're abusive. So tonight we want to pick back up on the relationship abuse series with our esteemed author, Veronica P. Lovin. Welcome into the Mind, Body, and Spirit Show.
Welcome, welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure because this is so timely. I was just speaking about how on the Greenleaf show, the young girl has encountered this abusive young man. Everything's been fine. He's like this gospel music artist. And then she critiqued his music. And all of a sudden, he reared that ugly head, that red flag appeared. Mm-hmm. And she noticed right away versus just excusing his behavior as a result of his stress, or, oh, maybe he's just trying to put on some airs in front of his friends. No, whatever the case is, you are being abusive. So I was so pleased that that was that image was shown in the show, because I think that not only young people but even some of us adults still may need to be reminded or informed of what's an abusive relationship. So we want to welcome you in to just tell us about your book, Feeding the Monster, and how did you come up with this title? What made you write this book?
Thank you. Feeding the Monster is a book I wrote, and it's about a few points. So it covers sexual assault, it covers molestation, and it covers rape. It's a memoir, so it's things that I've been through personally myself. And I decided to write it due to a big incident that happened in my life where my ex-husband of 21 years, he was the predator. And we discovered it. And so that's how it came out. After the trial and I saw that he got acquitted, I felt an obligation to write it.
When did you notice that he was a predator, that he had this abusive behavior?
Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20, right? I think that I probably noticed it early on. I didn't think he was abusive. So I was one of the people who thought, oh, I can fix him or help him. He wasn't necessarily physically abusive, and I say necessarily because he has pushed. He's done some things, but he wasn't, you know, violently beating me. But that, when you're still in a situation where someone makes you feel uncomfortable, or when somebody tries to exude power over you or your decisions, that's abuse. So I absolutely was in an abusive relationship, and I didn't recognize it early.
When you say predator,
mm-hmm.
what gives the title predator to you?
Yeah, that was a hard one. Actually, I'll tell you why I use the word predator, and it's because the attorneys, when he went to court, they were calling him a predator, and it was really hurtful to me at first because I was his wife, you know, and to hear those words were astonishing. But when I, as you know, the trial went on, as the years have gone on, I've understood the magnitude of what my ex-husband really did, and he was raping women with date rape drugs, not just my daughter, but more and more women came out after the trial. So that is why now I can label him a predator, because he figured out who he needed to manipulate, and then he did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, that is a predator.
Yeah.
He's definitely a predator. Oh, my goodness.
Capital P.
When you begin to manipulate women and manipulate people and mm-hmm. abuse them in that type of way, and you're basically preying on people that are most susceptible to those type of advances.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, the thing about a person like that, and the reason a person like me could be with him, is because he had that front. You know, even Ted Bundy had a great front. You know, a sociopath is a person, and they have these great fronts. They're the kindest people. They do things for people. Their image is most important to them. So that, I didn't go deep because I was emotionally injured myself from childhood, so I didn't even have the capacity at that time to even deal with his character. But I knew certain things about him that were not in alignment with me. And this is what I would like to say to, like, people in the audience or other people. When somebody's not in alignment with your character, meaning they're liars or they're manipulators, then you need to move away from them early. You know, you don't have to wait for the shoe to fall, the other foot to drop.
Okay.
Those things are not okay.
Not okay at all. You mentioned the emotional abuse that you experienced with your childhood. Do you think that sometimes these predators, it's almost like they can, just like a predator, they can smell that you have this abusive childhood or some type of emotions going on, and they just prey on certain people like that. Do you think that is so?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think because if you watch the world the way it works, a lot of times when someone becomes a victim, then they're open and susceptible to being a victim, a repeated victim. And usually that's because they feel powerless and they feel devalued. So then they allow things to happen to them, you know, that maybe a person without that problem wouldn't allow. So say, I was a nice-looking, smart young woman, and this man, when he lied to me the first time, maybe someone who didn't have the background that I had would have said, oh, no, like, he's a liar, but not me, you know, so then he could push a little further and push a little further. So they absolutely can recognize it, and they can smell it, like you said. Yes, I agree.
I believe it, because I know I've had, some unresolved issues in my life, and it's like I was constantly attracting the same type of person because I was so hurt and abused, and I was just constantly going in that circle, and I finally had to come to a reckoning with myself and say, wait a minute, it's not them I'm constantly complaining about. I need to slow down, man. No, it's me, and I need to get myself together because I keep picking these old raunchy lowdown men because I need to clean myself up and get myself together.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm hurting so much inside. I am just believing that this is what's for me, this raunchy lowdown
No good.
Right, you feel
man.
You deserve
it,
that.
It goes back to the quote, people will treat you as you treat yourself. They will pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
You train people.
And I say, until you understand your worth, you will allow yourself to be devalued. And then you make choices from a place of unworthiness, and your life reflects that state of being. So
you really
have to stand. Exactly. And we say that, and it's like, how do I do that? That was, you know, what I chose to do. Like, I had children early, and I put all of my energy into my children, and I did, you know, and that was like where my value came from. So what I would do is start thinking about, I had three girls and a boy. I would think about those girls, and if, say he did something, this is how I kind of started slowly shifting. I would be like, if this child, if somebody did this to my daughter, and now I had a daughter that I could actually look at, would I allow that? And if the answer was no, then I would try to stick up for myself in that area, if that makes sense. That's how I slowly started to change.
Wow.
And the funny part about
that
me is that... The different thing about me is that I was strong in so many other areas, and this is probably true about other women. Like at work, I was a strong force at work. You know, I made good money. I had a good job. I was, you know, all these things. But I had this big part of me that was unhealed, like you said. And it kept attracting this kind of man and this kind of situation and this hurt over and over and over again. But I didn't know how to fix it, so I just overcompensated with other things, which... You still have to go inside and heal that part of you that needs to be healed. It has to happen.
You have to do the work, the healing work.
Yes.
Absolutely.
You have to do the work.
How did you come up with the title, Feeding a Monster?
Well, it's kind of a play on words. It's a metaphorical title. And basically, I was thinking of how did I get here? And I thought, what did I do to contribute to this situation? Absolutely not did I know he was a rapist. No. But I knew he was a liar. And I feel like I fed some of those things by allowing things. You know, I allowed a lot of things to go on that probably should, well, not probably, that should not have gone on because of my low self-esteem. So I fed that monster. And I'm not calling him necessarily a monster, even though, you know, legitimately I could. But I'm calling anything in your life that you're feeding that is growing and destroying you or destructive, that is a monster that you are feeding. And you got to figure out what you're doing. Are you paying too much attention to it? You know, is it greed? Is it whatever it is you're doing? You got to learn how to stop feeding those monsters and start feeding your soul so that you have different results.
Yes, feeding your soul. Where you put your energy.
Yes. What you think about, you bring about.
Yes,
that is
true. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
control.
So the more you think about, the more you're going to bring about.
What are some of the ways, Veronica, that like victims who have experienced this type of abuse, how can they not only get out of this and survive, but like how can they begin to repair themselves after leaving these relationships? Because let me just tell you this quickly. I was in this emotional abusive relationship. I promise, it seems like it took me almost a year and a half to just get back to some stability. I will have to say that. I mean, I know I felt completely off. I felt shifted. I felt like I felt like I was off centered for a while. It took a lot of healing. So, what do you suggest? What are some ways that people can repair themselves?
I think you begin with forgiving yourself and not judging yourself. And I think that starts the healing process. When you stop, you let go of your ego and you let go of worrying about why I did it, what I could have done differently, and you nurture yourself. You know, you love yourself back to health like you would, you know, if it was another, like a little girl. You would hug her, you would love her, you would do things for her, you would tell her it wasn't her fault. You know, you can reach out.
Yeah.
You nurture that child within. And then you also get help when you need help. And that was one of my bigger things. I always wanted to do everything. I used to say, by myself. Because I felt as a child I wasn't protected, and I felt like I needed to come through things by myself. I had to let that go, and I had to reach out for help. I had to look around and see who I was surrounded with and allow people to help me. So those are the couple of things. And you're specifically asked for what you need, you know, and you take those steps. You kind of surrender, you know, and you allow God to work through you. So the first step for me, again, just to reiterate it, was forgiveness, and mostly forgiving myself, and to re-nurture myself and to ask for help.
Nurture yourself.
I think that's a good beginning.
Mm-hmm. It took quite a while for me to begin to ask for help, because I always wanted to be that super woman, because as women, and in particularly as women of color, we feel like we have to do it all. I can accomplish it all. I can hold the baby, open the door, and cook dinner, and everything goes all simultaneously.
Right.
Answer the phone, talk on the phone, and complete some other time, whatever it is. Work on your master's, you know, all at the same time, and then be ready for sex at night when hubby comes home. So
exactly.
We feel like we can accomplish all of these feats and this portrayal of superwoman. I learned a few years ago that it's okay to ask for help. It is okay. Sometimes
it's okay.
For me, I always say, yes, it's okay. I always say, it's okay for me to be that damsel in distress sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Let me be
mm-hmm.
a damsel in distress. Let me ask for some help when I need it, because what you'll find is people will help you. They will help.
Absolutely. They're waiting to help you. And you know what I discovered, too, is the beauty of women friendships. You know, it was amazing, especially when I talk to women around the country, the connection. And sometimes you just need each other. I was kind of a loner in that. I had friends, but I didn't really divulge what I was going through with them. Had I spoken up a little bit more, I probably would have had that sistership. You know what I mean? And it's powerful. That sistership is powerful, and it's something that we need and we thrive upon. And that's another way to really help heal yourself, because once you speak out, somebody be like, I did that too. You're like, oh really? You're not alone,
right? You know that's something that predators also look for too. They look for loners, so that when
isolate you
goes wrong, right, it's easier to isolate you from everybody.
Mhm.
Mhm. But who can call when something doesn't seem right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 That is a common tactic. Let me make sure I can isolate. If you're not already a person that is not in contact with your family and friends, then that's just perfect. Mm-hmm. But
I feel a lot of protecting. I feel like I protected him a lot, probably more so to protect myself, because if he came in at 3 or 4 in the morning, that's unacceptable. I would tell him, like, don't do that, but I wouldn't tell, like, my mother or my friends, because then the next time he comes in, they're going to hold me accountable. They're going to say, hey, well, what'd you do about that? And I didn't do anything about it. So I couldn't say anything until I was ready to make a move, because I didn't want to be reminded and I didn't want to make him look bad. But you don't consciously think those things out. You just do it as you're in that situation. And that's what a lot of people in abusive situations do. Because you know you're going back.
Yes, it's like, let me try to work this out. You know, I'll get him straight. We'll work it out. I'll get her straight, or she'll stop doing that. She'll stop flirting. Mm-hmm. She'll stop flirting. And That's just that person.
It's their character.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you
like to have another question. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Veronica, you were saying something?
I'm here. No. Go ahead. I was listening to the question.
Oh, okay. We were while we're on the subject of family and friends, people that you can talk mm-hmm. to, one thing I was wondering about is that do you find that sometimes family members are not supportive of the victim getting out of the situation for reasons like they may like the abuser because they only see their good side, or mm-hmm. maybe it's a benefit to them in some way that the two of them stay together, like in the movie, Halle Perry's movie, Family Reunion, like the mother did mm-hmm. not, she knew what was going on, but she did not want her daughter to break up with this rich guy. Or maybe it's because they've experienced abuse themselves, and they feel like, you know, no big deal, they live through it, just, you know, be strong and take it. So mm-hmm. do you feel that happens sometimes, and that can also be a barrier to them leaving?
Absolutely, and I think a lot of times in, you know, Black families, that's and, you know, Hispanic families, probably poor families, because you feel like the person, say that the person offers you, just like you said in the movie, a financial gain, and it's benefiting the rest mm-hmm. of the family.
Right.
People are like, hey, just tolerate a little bit, you know, like tolerate, because mm-hmm. they're in fear. They're afraid mm-hmm. that they'll lose everything. And you mm-hmm. got to kind of step back and say, you know, and you think about it, this is your daughter. Some mothers will do that. They'll sacrifice their daughters for the good of financial reasons. So that, to me, is a huge character flaw. But absolutely
yeah.
that happens. And it happens yeah. more often than we would like to even think about.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I think when you tell me that, I think of Nicole, Nicole Simpson. You know, I don't know the whole story, what was 100% true, what wasn't, but I do know that she was in an abusive relationship, and I know her family supported that relationship, you know, by any means mm-hmm. necessary, because he was the breadwinner, and he was the star.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of times you
OJ.
Sacrifice your soul. Yeah, you
yeah.
sacrifice your
yeah.
soul for the love of money. I mean, that's...
OJ. Mm-hmm. And he's the breadwinner, as you mentioned, and he is supporting not just you, but this entire family.
Right. Yes.
We don't want those funds to decrease.
Right,
so, yeah.
right.
And sometimes they would go so far, what did you do now? You know,
mm-hmm.
like you brought
mm-hmm.
this on yourself. What did you do? You know?
Yeah, and that would be a situation. And like even with my family didn't know what he was doing, my personal family. But my ex-husband's family was a huge part of our family, and they didn't want me to bring this out when it happened. They wanted to sweep it under the rug and move on, and let's just make nice. But you can't, you know, integrity-wise, you can't, especially if you know me as a person. You hurt my child, that's where you get me. You know, everybody has their weak points, and I hope, you know, with my children, you can't, that's my weak point. I took a lot for myself, you know, which I shouldn't have, but I did, but not right. when it came to my kids. And I feel like his family absolutely wanted to sweep it under the rug. They told me so it's not even that I felt
mm-hmm.
they told mm-hmm. me, like, let's keep this, don't go to the
police. That line for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they were they felt that I should have come to them, and we should have talked about it. And it was like, we got to go to the police on this one. So I got shunned, and the whole family, most of them, 98% of them, turned their backs on me and my kids for telling the truth and for speaking up.
Oh, goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have the support from your family.
Excuse me?
You didn't, not having that support from your family, I'm sure that was extremely difficult, because you're already experiencing this abuse, and then it's almost like then you're having this abuse from your family because they're not supportive of you going through these situations that you're experiencing. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard. It was difficult. Yeah. My kids lost their grandparents, you know, on my ex-husband's side, because they were really close to them, and they just kind of walked away and turned their back because I spoke up, you know. And he was the prize of the family. He used to play professional baseball. He was, you know, the one doing the best. A lot of that was me making it happen financially, but they loved that part of it, and they didn't want to see that end. And that was, you know, a turning point for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that trickles down to the children. That's the point there. Like if one of the spouses is experiencing the abuse, and then it's like you don't think the children are aware, but children are so aware. They pay attention.
Yeah.
And they notice a lot more than we may think. Were your children young at this time and you didn't think they were aware of what was going on, or were you aware that they could see that there was some abuse taking place in the home?
I think that I was probably not the wisest in that area. I thought that I did such a good job. I spent most of the time with my kids. My ex-husband didn't physically abuse me, nor did he like call me names or anything like that. His abuse was more emotional. He would be gone. He would be out till 4 or 5 in the morning. He would spend the night, you know, different places. He was cheating. So I thought that they had no idea, because, you know, he'd be home in the morning by the time they got there. You know, I whispered my arguments. I tried to make sure that they didn't hear. But they knew, and I didn't. They didn't know all of it, but later on, they said, "We knew you were sad, Mom." And I was like, "Me? You know, I thought I had a big old happy face." But they knew. So absolutely, your kids know, and you got to kind of, you got to know that. And I thought I was absolutely wonderful at protecting them from that, and they felt it. They did.
So you mentioned that that he abused your daughter. How did you find out that he abused your daughter?
I was out of town working, and she was turned 21, and he had taken her to drink the first time, to teach her how to drink, he said. He told her, "Let's not tell Mom, because she wouldn't approve of me teaching you how to drink, but I want you to know all the ins and outs of what, you know, to do and not to do." So that was the first part. He had her keep a secret. He noticed that she kept the secret. So the second time he takes her out, he drugs her. And she just noticed that she just thought she drank too much. And she was with her father, so she was safe. But she woke up with him in her bed. And that she was drugged, so she couldn't really like scream or anything like that. And that was probably God protecting her, because it could have been a whole different ending to this story if he had known that she was awake. So she called me, and she didn't tell me what. She told me she needed me to come home right away, and please don't tell Dad. So I thought it was something to do with her, you know, like she was pregnant or something, you know, that I would have to deal with. So I thank God I listened, because like me and my husband were super close. We talked all the time, and for some reason I listened and I didn't tell him anything. He didn't even know I was coming back. So I flew home from San Francisco. She picked me up from the airport. She told me that, and we went straight to the police station. And that's how it all unfolded.
Had he been with your daughter from baby to he went off to college?
Yes.
He had been with it in the household.
Yes. He had been.
So he watched her grow up.
Yes, he was at all her teacher conferences, all her track meets. You know, he was daddy.
So did you mention that he had been? This was the first time that something like this happened.
Yes,
did she say that?
Absolutely thinks that. Now she thinks maybe there might have been a fuzzy time. You know, we really, really trusted him. She trusted him. You know, he took care of us. He made her feel really safe and protected. So he's never been in their room or acted inappropriate. So she never thought that. But now when we're looking back, that first time, she's thinking maybe he could have done something that time. So we don't know if he did it like the time before that, but we know absolutely the second time he did it.
Yeah. That's why I asked the question. Was he with her in the household from baby up until now?
And we have two other daughters together as well. And neither one of them say that he's ever done anything like that. So
they're younger? Are they younger?
They're younger. And then, but after my daughter spoke up and the trial was about to happen, one of my nieces spoke up and said that he picked her up from school one day and that she was, he taught her how to drink, and she was 16, and she thought some things happened, but she couldn't remember, so she never said anything. So we know that it's happened more now, you know, but no one spoke up or said anything until my daughter spoke up. And then even during the trial, you know, I guess women, a lot of women were waiting for him to go to jail, you know, and then when they found out he didn't, that's when they spoke up after the trial. So it would have been helpful if I would have had more ammunition during the trial, because I could have marched, you know, this woman, that woman, this woman.
Oh,
a lot of
goodness.
People didn't want to speak up. They were afraid, and they were also afraid because they knew we were married, and maybe they were on a date with him when they were, you know, they felt they shouldn't have been, but they were with him. So those are the type of people he picked. So then they're not going to say anything because they're going to look bad.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so, you know exactly which women.
What he did.
Yes. Just like a predator, they know exactly which targets to go for. Let's take a quick break and let's come back and pick back up on some of the points that you've made tonight. We just need to take a quick break. You're tuned in to the Mind, Body, and Spirit Show, and we are here with author and advocate, motivational speaker, Veronica Peace Loving, author of Feeding the Monster. And while we're on this break, you can go and purchase Feeding the Monster. Where can people find your book, Veronica?
Okay, it's called Feeding a Monster, because there's a Feeding the Monster, too, and it's not that one. It's Feeding a Monster.
A Monster.
On Amazon.com, or you can go to VeronicaLoving.com and purchase it that way.
Great. Now, I love your name. We'll be right back.
Oh, thank you.
Into the Mind, Body, and Spirit Radio Show.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
We are back here at Mind, Body, and Spirit Radio Show on Black Talk Radio Network, and you can log on to Black Talk Radio Network and donate to the Black Talk Media Project, where you can receive your Black Talk Radio Matters t-shirt and also sign up for the Social Media Experience BTR while you're on the page as well. We want to welcome back author Veronica P. Loving, and we are discussing abuse, sexual assault abuse, being in abusive relationships, and how that impacts your self-esteem, and when to speak out, how to identify an abuser, a predator. And we were discussing how it just seems like these predators, they know exactly the people to target. It's like they can smell that you have something going on with you, something that they can key in on or zoom in on, and it's like, yes, you. I'm going to work you. I'm going to wreck your life. So, just speaking about, just listening to how he took advantage of your daughter, I'm just sitting here in amazement, but I know it happens. But what's even more, I guess, astonishing is how we always tend to want to keep this a secret and hold this in. And we don't want to reveal this because of whatever reason, whatever we may feel, how it would hurt us or hurt the next person or how people would view us. How can we even get past that of just speaking?
up if only just amongst family, because it seemed like, as you mentioned, it's always family that's suppressing you versus being supportive of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is important, and that's one of my messages, is to speak up. If your family, a lot of times people come from a chain of abuse, so if your family may not be, they may be hiding it. Like my ex-husband's family, a lot of them have been abused. There was a chain of abuse. They didn't want to speak up, and they didn't support me when I did. So you have to be able to remove yourself from that. If it's your personal family, you got to be able to remove yourself from that and reach out to either an organization or someone who will help you get through this and not keep these people's secrets. That's how they grow. You keep a secret of a predator, that predator is free to continue to do it to others. When you speak up, it dulls their light. It blocks some of the things that they can do. Because even if they get off on it, people know you said he did that. So he's not as free to move about and do the things that he would normally do. And the more people that speak up, then you inspire change.
So it's important to speak out, and speak out as soon as possible. Get the help that you need. Let someone know. And it helps with, as you mentioned, being in touch with other friends and family also. At least someone will know. It will be at least someone, at least one person, I would hope, in your circle that will be there. Some kind of way. You would hope.
And if you feel like there's no one that you can talk to, especially for younger, younger girls and younger guys, you have to go to a teacher or a counselor. They're trained to, know what to do and call the right people. So, you have to come in contact with someone outside of your family or your circle where you feel that you couldn't speak up. Because say my daughter spoke up to me and I was sicker than that, I was even worse than I was. And I protected him. That happens every single day. Women will think, let me keep this piece of man. And they'll go into denial and try to protect the man. And their children, spoke up, and they don't protect their children. So that happens more often than we want to talk about. So you got to have other avenues. You have to remember that you have teachers. You got to remember that you have, counselors, principals, or somewhere else outside church. You can speak to your pastor or someone. But you got to have other avenues where you can say your truth, and just keep saying it until you get the help that you need.
And we always advocate here at Mind, Body, and phone and call one of those help crisis lines, abuse lines, victims lines, something, suicide.
Absolutely.
They will connect you with who you need to be connected with. Just pick up your phone and reach out to someone. And these days, with social media, they can connect with so many people. You may can post something on social media for help, and someone may see it and reach out to you and connect with you and provide the assistance that you need. There's so many resources out here. But again, you have to be able to identify that you're being abused and then take those steps. So that's important as well.
And I think people are. Oh, go ahead.
No. You said you were about to say you think people are.
I think people are surprised when we say we have to learn how to identify abuse, because people think, oh, well, I would know abuse, but sometimes it's so subtle and it's slow and it's meticulous that you don't realize you're in it until you're deep in it. So that's why we were saying, let's identify these things. And I think most importantly, when something doesn't feel right, God gave us intuition. When something doesn't feel right, you have to have the strength and the courage to walk away sooner than later.
And when you say doesn't feel right, give some listeners an example, because some people... they may still have some doubts or be conflicted about that. So is it like that gut feeling that you may
have? It's a gut feeling. Some people call it the still small voice. You have to really tune in and try to listen for it. We all have it. they say women actually have a keener instinct voice. It's your instinct. So when you feel when something is displaced, and I think you use that word, like you felt out of alignment, then you know that you have to make some changes, because we have to walk in alignment. So if somebody is doing something and you realize this isn't right, you'll know. Your gut will tell you, and you have to follow that. That's the most important thing, is that gut.
And
you work so hard. Go ahead.
I'm hard. Yes. I would also say, if you are feeling that something's just not right, as you mentioned, and you have more questions than answers, and you're not feeling secure, there's always this ambiguity. Like, wait a minute, why are you doing this, or why is this, or I thought you said. So just paying attention to those different little red flags that may flare up. Like, those things that make you say, that just doesn't sound right. It doesn't
things that make you go,
Yeah.
But also you have to have the courage.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you have to have the courage and the faith. That a lot of people walk in fear. And if you switch that to faith, knowing that God doesn't want you hurt, you know, God doesn't want you in these situations, and He will provide a way, you have that will help you build courage to let go of the pain, or to let go of whatever it is that's causing you this pain, which is usually an abusive person or an abusive situation. Yeah. You will go through, you get through it.
You will get through it. Extract yourself from it.
Yes.
Definitely. All right. Well, Featherlight, do you have any more questions for Miss Loving?
No, I don't. I have really I've really gotten a lot out of just talking with her. I mean, it's so interesting. It's amazing what is going on. Some things we know about, and some things we're just, you know, shake your head. I'm so glad you're doing this. And let me applaud you first for not only getting through it, but being brave enough to speak out about it, write about it, let other people know that this kind of thing is going on and what they need to do to look out for it, and also to get out of it. And then there's a quote that says, you mentioning he was coming home like 3 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the morning and what have you. And those kinds of things, they may not appear to some people as abuse, but it makes you kind of wonder, you know, like, do we have a good relationship? I mean, where do I stand? I can't do this. I can't talk to him. You know, where do I stand? If you don't know where you stand with someone, it's time for you to stop standing and walk away.
Absolutely.
Walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Walk
away.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give this call center number to those who are listening who may feel that they need to talk to someone and they may not have someone that they're close enough to. The number is 1-800-273-8255. And it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's 1-800. It's the crisis call. What if you got a crisis? Period. 1-800-273-8255. And these people care. They have empathy. They will get it. Some people don't get it. They will get it.
Yeah, we've been through some stuff. And I wanted to let you all know how to reach me and how to, you know, if you want to connect with me on social media. I'm on I Am Veronica Loving on Instagram. And I have a Facebook page, I Am Veronica Loving. And Twitter is Veronica Loving 1.
Veronica Loving, because some people may want to put a K in there or leave off the G.
Oh, that's true. It's V E V as in victory, E R O N ICALOVING. And that's I am Veronica Loving.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wonderful. I got it. Thank you so much.
Great.
To visit and share with us this evening.
Thank you for having me. It's really important that we get this message out there, and I appreciate you being there and having your audience, and thank you to your audience.
Yes, indeed. It is important to get this message out.
Okay. Well, have a great
evening. Best wishes to you.
Okay, and your book is in the mail.
Oh, good. Thank you. Wonderful. Namaste.
All right, have a good night. And that was author Veronica P. Loving, the author of Feeding a Monster. Yes, you need
monster.
To be able to feeding a monster. Feeding a monster. Feeding a monster.
Yes.
Not feeding the monster. Feeding a monster. I'm looking right at it because I'm trying to follow her on Twitter. I'm following her on Twitter right now. Yes, and at Twitter, Loving Veronica One is how you can find her, author, speaker, advocate. And if you want to have her come and speak to your group, you can reach out to her on Twitter or at her website, Veronica Loving. And I think that would be a great, great, great talk for some of the young people coming out, or even some of the senior women, older women, not just for young people, because many women that are not teenagers or adolescents or millennials, women in their late 30s and 40s could still be experiencing all kinds of abuse and just haven't been able to identify it. But like connecting with someone like Veronica Levin, you can learn how to not only identify the abuse but also figure out a way to get out of it. And how do you realign yourself, as I said, repair yourself after that abusive relationship, because that's traumatic. That is very traumatic. That's traumatic once you go through that. Once you go through an abusive relationship, that crap will wear you out.
And it is important that the first thing you do is forgive yourself, because you will beat up on yourself. You'll say, all that time I wasted, I should have known. You just think of a million things to say.
Mm-hmm. Why did I do that? What's I should have known.
Right. And it's funny how instead of putting the blame on the person who actually did the horrible things, you put the blame on yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We often do that. We blame ourselves, mm-hmm. especially if you don't have that support system around you. To ensure you that you're not the predator or the perpetrator, you're the victim. You're actually the victim, it's not necessary for you to continue to put yourself down. I had to learn to forgive myself on quite a few things, and thankfully I had a good friend that addressed it with me. Forgiving myself first, and that's the healing process. That starts the healing.
Mm-hmm. Certainly
does. It's a
big
thing. Forgive. Absolutely. Forgive yourself. Love yourself.
An advocate for that.
Love yourself. I'm going to order her book too. I already saved it in my Amazon list. So I just need to go back and order it. So I think it'll be a great read and something to share with others also. Satellite, we have got to pick back up on Dr. John Hewitt Clark, because last week we did not have an opportunity to play the video.
Hi.
Dr. John Hewitt Clark. So I just want to speak briefly on Dr. John Hewitt Clark, again, one of my favorites, Pan-Africanist writer, historian, professor, and a pioneer in the creation of Africana studies and professional institutions in academia. Starting in the late 1960s, he was born on January 1st, 1915, in Union Springs, Alabama.
died July 12, 1998 at the age of 83 in Manhattan, New York City. And this writer, historian, and professor has a way of telling our history and sharing our history and educating us with his wit and just like a library of information about our history and European history and world history, period. Let's see. He was professor of Black and Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College of the City University of New York from 1969 to 1986, where he served as a founding chairman of the department. And he was also the Carter D. Woodson Distinguished Visiting Professor of African History at Cornell University's Africana Studies and Research Center. Additionally, in 1968, he founded the African Heritage Studies Association and the Black Caucus of the African Studies Association. And he would often tell stories of his encounters with Malcolm X. And he and Dr. Ben, I would love to hear them speak. And there's this master lecture that they have. They're called the master teachers, and they truly are the master teachers. I love this one quote with Dr. Ben, and he was on a panel, and he was debating some people, and he said he only debates his equals, all other he teach. And I just love him. I love him for all that he represents. I love him for sharing all of the knowledge that he shared over the years. He is the author of countless books. I'm just looking over here at some of the books that I have. I meant to pull out one of those books. I think the first book that I may have read by him was, it was a book on an analysis of the transatlantic slave trade, I believe. But Dr. Clark, once again, one of my absolute favorites. So we are going to listen to this clip tonight, Dr. John Henry Clark, because we did not get that clip in. So let me see if Scotty can pull that clip for us. Scotty, you have that clip?
I was supposed to be here early. They gave me another assignment. They didn't pick me up to go to the assignment. I followed their instructions and waited at the hotel. I would love to be here when I can be more fully in depth on this subject, because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Right. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it. I'm saying that all organized present religions are male chauvinist murder cults. And I say there is no exception. Well, I wanted to be here earlier. I wanted to deal with our relationship with the people of the world and the fact that we created peaceful nations that had no word for jail because no one had ever gone to one. No word for old people's home because no one had ever thrown away grandma and grandpa. No word for orphanages. We did all of this, and over half of human civilization was over before we knew that a European was in the world. Before he wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window. Now, Africa has always and still is the prize for the whole world. We as a people have always been the world's richest people, culturally rich, mineral rich. We have always been the prize because we have always had and still have something that other people won't, think they can't do without, and don't care to pay for. Because we have always been the prize, we have been under siege for over 3,000 years. Nothing that ever brought into Africa from the outside was meant to do the African any good. That means all other religions. Islam was the handmaiden of Arab imperialism. Christianity was the handmaiden of European imperialism. The Hebrew faith was the handmaiden of a concept called the chosen people. Now, if God is kind and God is merciful and God has no stepchildren, he won't choose one over the other. And to say he chose some people, you're making him a bigot. And to say that he endorsed enslavement of one people over the other, you're making him an accessory to murder. The Arabs used Islam to rationalize their slavery and their imperialism. The Europeans used Christianity to rationalize their slavery and imperialism. Who are you kidding about friends in the world? Damn it, if you want a friend, look in the mirror. There's 1 billion African people on the face of this earth. Why are you buying third-rate junk from third-rate people thinking you can't make it? Why don't you at least make a safety pin to hold your child's diaper together?
Teach.
Who has programmed your mind at thinking you can't make a car? The first man that made a car that had never seen one previously.
Teach.
The Japanese bought cars, bought locomotives, broke them down and studied them, and had a Japanese technician produce each piece, put it together, and had a much better train than the one they copied from. All knowledge in the world belongs to everybody in the world.
Yes.
Who has programmed our mind in assuming that we cannot run a nation and run it well? The main thing imperialism did, slavery and imperialism, they removed African people from the respectful commentary of history. And they tell them something they are still telling them, and all of the organized religions are guilty of this. I favor none of it because Africa didn't need any of it. I'm saying that African belief systems, properly understood, is 10 times better than Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And better for the Africans. So you might have some romance with one of these religions. I have no romance with any of them. I have a romance with reality and truth. And the chips can fall where they may after I tell it. As for friends, you have had no friends. When they discovered you, they began to prey on you. Now let's look at our relationship with Western Asia, mistakenly called the Middle East. For 3,000 years, our greatest enemies came from Western Asia. They were trying to avenge the fact that they were once African colonies. You read a book called When Egypt Ruled the East, and you get some of the basic information on this. Now, the first visitors to Africa came in the 1700s B.C. These were the people who would later be called Hebrews. Now, black people are ticklish on this because black people think that everything in the Bible is true. I question the intelligence of anyone who thinks everything in the Bible is true or supposed to be true. It's allegory, stories told to illustrate a point at a time when there were very few people reading books. And most of what went into the making of the Bible was copied from Egyptian texts. Now, if you want to get so dewy-eyed over the Bible, which is a carbon copy of a carbon copy, why don't you go back and read the original Egyptian text? Then you see where all these stories started from. You see where the story of the Exodus started from. Now, you get so dewy-eyed, you actually think there was an Exodus. These people walked into Africa. Why couldn't they walk out? Why did they have to go by sea? Why did sea have to part? If you read Egyptian literature, you will discover that the whole story of somebody parting the sea started with about 3,000 years before the Hebrew entrance. I should not use the word Hebrew entrance, but the entrance from Western Asia. Now let's get one thing straight, because black people are confused about all religions. Now, I'm not against any religion. I'm a very spiritual human being. I just don't need a preacher to preach no Ten Commandments to me when he's a backslider going with some sister, some other man's wife. I'm intelligent enough to pick from the Ten Commandments. We were not commandments anyway, but they were omissions of purity at the great school at Luxor, the great African training school. All right, now, let's get into this Western Asia. I'm saying that the people who came from Western Asia escaping famine did not have any Hebrew faith when they came into Africa. And there's no record of a Hebrew faith before there. Why is it that when they left Africa in the so-called Exodus, they had all three? African culture, an African religion, and an African language. Now look at the origin of the so-called people you now refer to as Jews. You're mistaken using that reference, because the word Jew is of European origin. And the people in Europe who call themselves by their name
Right, and that was the late great Dr. John Henry Black, speaking on spirituality.
I wanted to hear the end of that. I'm going to have to click on and hear the rest of that. That was
actually, I think it's like multiple parts to that, so you can go online. I think I definitely will. I think three or four parts. Oh, yeah, he definitely drops the knowledge. Dr. John Henry Clark, I love him. I want to say that the title of that one was Religion versus Spirituality. Yes.
Yeah, the name of the full video on YouTube is Dr. John Henry Clark, We Have No Friends. That's the name of the full lecture.
Ah.
Is that one, We Have No Friends?
No friends.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We Have No Friends. We Have No Friends. I think I may have that one. I may have that on CD here. Telling my age when I say I have it on CD. But that's a great lecture. That's a great one. We Have No Friends. All right, so we'll take a quick break and we will be back. You are tuned into the Mind, Body, and Spirit, and we're coming back with Southern Light and Her Love's a Body. So stay tuned.
Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, Visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Namaste, and we are back, and it is time to love your body with Feather Light. Feather Light, you're going to talk to us about loving the body. We just loved our mind with some John Henry Clark, and now let's love our body.
I love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. And we'll close out with the spirit. Okay. So, parents, put your children to bed. Tell them good night. This is grown folks talk. We're moving into. We've talked about Sanskrit, not Sanskrit, but Tantra, tantric sex, under the heading of Tantra, the style, the ritual, it's a practice. It's not a religion. It's just like yoga. Anybody can do it. And tantric sex, we talked about that a few weeks ago. So I wanted to share with the audience about a type of massage that has dual purpose. It's called the yoni massage. And yoni is a Sanskrit word for the vagina, which is broken down. It means sacred space, source of all life. So the yoni massage has two purposes. It's the yoni massage therapy for women sexually abused, or massaging the yoni for pleasure and orgasm. Now, 1 out of 4 women have in some way been sexually abused. We've had our guest speaker sharing with us about the abuse that she went through, as well as her daughter. So, sexual abuse can affect a woman or a man in many, many ways long after the event, and sometimes those feelings or emotions, the energy, negative energy, gets trapped in your body and it needs to escape because it affects in many ways your the way you feel about yourself. So yoni massage is a therapeutic practice, as well as done in tantric sex for pure enjoyment. There is no penetration involved. This is strictly, although an orgasm or two or three may happen, but it is all about the woman. It's all about her healing, or it's about her pleasure. So, and it's also especially beneficial for women who have never had an orgasm. That's on the pleasure side. It's not just about having one orgasm. It's about trying to feel more and more pleasure that will become like waves of multiple orgasms throughout the whole massage. So you can do this alone, partner. You can do it as therapy, as I said, or as foreplay. Now, foreplay to love making. You want to include that in your tantric sex. Or, if it's for healing, a sex therapist that you trust. So, yoni massage allows you time to slowly explore your body. You would be amazed as to how many women do not know their body sensually. I mean, you can look at, you know, okay, oh, this breast is bigger than that breast. Oh, my waist is, you know. But I mean, sensually. Many women do not sensually know their body. They feel that they shouldn't touch their bodies. It's something wrong if you touch your
something
own
forbidden.
Body. Forbidden. It's a word. I think it starts with a T, but it's something that they didn't feel that they
taboo. Yes, it's taboo to please yourself, to touch yourself. There's something wrong with you. But if you don't know what you like, how are you going to explain to somebody else what you like? All you realize is that, hey, I'm not getting what he's getting. So it's nothing wrong with that. The yoni massage can be very healing for those who have suffered sexual trauma in their past, because the approach and the technique is all about giving to the woman, making her feel loved, cherished, worshipped, honored, all of that. And that is what is lacking in a lot of women who have been sexually abused. So this is, as you can see, it would be very therapeutic. It's like a whole body experience. It's not just for the yoni, because the whole body is involved. Touching, arousing, and massaging the whole body, focusing on the neck, the shoulders. I carry tensions in my shoulders. Most of us do the buttocks, the stomach. Most of the time, we forget about the woman's stomach. A lot of nerves are located in a woman's stomach. The hips, they're massaged. And then finally, the outside and the inside of the yoni, while continuing to massage the rest of the body. It's no sex, no penetration. It's to give the recipient. It's all about giving to the recipient. And there's a strong focus, this is when it's therapeutically done, on healing and holding space for whatever emotions come up. And of course, before it's begun, if this is not part of your tantric sex, if it's for therapeutic intentions, then the two actually sit down and talk about what they expect to get from it. And a safe word is set before the massage begins, because this will be new, you know, to actually just have someone touch you all over and then strictly massage your vagina. So maybe you may feel like, oh, no, I don't want it. So a safe word is set.
A safe word.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
A safe word, okay. I was just trying to hear what you said. A safe word, all right.
Yes.
That's always good.
Safe word. Yes, a safe word. Red, blue, whatever, something quick that you can say. There's clear communication about boundaries and sensation. There are clear intentions for both the receiver and the giver that discuss before the massage. This is for therapeutic healing. It's for awakening. It's for transformation, as well as pleasure. It's very, very, very healing and releasing, because some women have not experienced an orgasm. They really haven't. And being able to release like that without having to do anything or worry about pleasing someone else, that would be a good thing to try. It's very beneficial for just about any woman, but especially for women who've gone through some type of sexual trauma or who have never had.
I'm just laughing because you said it's very beneficial, and it's really beneficial for women that have gone through something. But yeah, I think for all of us, I think having that, I would hope that having an orgasm is very beneficial for all of us. I enjoy it. I definitely.
No, I mean the whole idea of a yoni massage.
Oh, the yoni massage. Okay. Oh, okay.
I mean, of course, every woman would love an orgasm. We are talking about your demon part. You think you're going on part. All to the orgasm part.
See? Yep. See where my mind is. Excuse me.
Yeah. So, that is what the yoni massage is about. Oh, they're different tactics or techniques. You start with an open mind, because really, some women, when you think of, you know, yoni massage, but you start with an open mind, open heart, no judgment of yourself or your body. Connecting with your breath is very important, as in Tantra. That's a very key element in the Tantra practice. Bliss breath is used. It helps you to feel a total orgasm, not just in the sexual organs, but total throughout the whole body. So that technique of breathing, bliss breathing, orgasm way beyond normal. So also, it grounds you in your body and keeps you out of your head, and it just helps to spread the orgasmic energy throughout your body. So, have you ever heard of edging?
I have not heard of edging. What the heck is edging?
Edging is, the goal is to reach the edge of an orgasm over and over again. So when the body seems ready to explode, you slow it down, pull away, then you build it back up again to create multiple waves of orgasm instead of just one. That's what edging is. Sounds interesting.
Oh, yes. Okay, edging. Yes.
So there are 5 yoni massage techniques involved. Circling, pushing and pulling, tugging and rolling, tapping, and finally, drum roll, the G-spot. Many people don't know where the G-spot is. So this is very important in the yoni massage. And that, ladies and gents, guys and dolls, is the yoni massage. Namaste.
Yoni massage. Is there a certain amount of time for the yoni massage, or time length? Or you just feel your partner connect?
Yes. I would say, this I haven't tried yet, but I would say that when the receiver is just exhausted beyond exhaustion and has had multiple waves of orgasms after edging, then she would probably do the safer, like, or just, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done. Mm-hmm. And pass out.
I'm just thinking about
you. But to answer your question, no, there's no time limit. Just like with tantra sex, there's no specific amount of time.
And don't worry about the time.
That's the beautiful of it. That's the beauty of it. I mean, there's no time. You don't think about time at all.
Mm-hmm. You're just thinking about the moment.
You're out of your head. Yes, you're out of your head. You're out of your head.
Moment and pleasure. All right.
Yes.
I can dig it. Can you dig it? Yes, I can. I'm ready for my yoni massage. I'm ready for it. All right, then. I think I need to probably just breathe. Take some time and breathe. Yes, how about that? Just take us into some breathing. I enjoyed the author, though, Veronica P. Lovin. And again, you can check out her book on Amazon or go to her website, speaking on relationship abuse and how to get out of that crazy thing. And don't forget to go on to Black Talk Media Network webpage so that you can
continue listening to all of the other amazing shows on Black Talk Media Network and donate to the Black Talk Media Network project also, so that we can continue supporting Black Talk Media, Black Media, definitely. All right, so Father Light, you want to give us some breathing and close us out?
Yes, I will. I'm going to give you two. Usually I give you something to relax you, but with the stress of today, many times while you're on the job, you're running low on energy, and you still have about 3 or 4 more hours of work to put in. So this is called the stimulating breath. So what you do is you inhale and exhale rapidly through your nose, keeping your mouth closed, but relaxed. And your breath in and out should be equal in duration, but as short as possible. So this is a noisy breathing exercise, so you probably need to go to the restroom, but let me give you a demonstration. Okay. So you would try to do about, let's see, 1, 2, 3 in a second. 3 in and out breath cycles per second. Okay. So you don't do it for more than 15 seconds on your first try. Each time you practice this stimulating breath, you can increase your time by, 5 seconds or so until you reach a full minute. If done properly, you'll feel invigorated, comparable to the heightened awareness you feel after a good workout. You should also feel the effect at the back of your neck, your diaphragm, your chest, and your abdomen. So, this is called the stimulating breath, also called the bellows breath, B-E-L-L-O-W-S. Okay, so this is the relaxing breath. It's 4, 7, 8. It's very popular. You can Google it. You breathe in 4, hold for 7, and exhale 4, 8. Well, the 4, 7, 8 is very simple. It takes almost no time. You don't need any equipment. You can do it anywhere. And it suggests that you sit with your back straight while you're learning this. Now, the key is to put the tip of your tongue against the ridge of the tissue just behind the upper front teeth, in the little ridge part. Keep your tongue there the whole time. You're going to be exhaling through your mouth around your tongue. You have to keep your tongue there. You can pierce your lips slightly if it feels kind of awkward. So first you're going to do is exhale completely through your mouth, making a whoosh sound. Close your mouth and inhale quietly through your nose to a mental count of 4. Then you're going to hold your breath for a count of 7. Then exhale, making a whoosh sound through your mouth of 8. This is one breath. Do this 3 times. Exhale to start. Close your mouth. Inhale through your nose. Count of 4. Hold 7. Exhale completely through your mouth, making a whoosh sound. That's one breath. So you are exhaling toxins, and you're relaxing your nervous system. Always inhale quietly through your nose and exhale audibly through your mouth. And your tip of your tongue stays in that position the whole time. So exhaling takes twice as long as inhaling. And this is a natural tranquilizer for the nervous system. And unlike tranquilizing drugs, which are often ineffective after you take them for a while, they lose their power. This is subtle when you first try it, but it gains in power with repetition and practice. At least twice a day.
love it. I need to kind of like write those steps down though, because I was trying to like go through the breathing process too, but I need to write those down. So we may need to put those up on our page.
Okay. It's really easy to remember. It's called 478.
Oh,
478. You can type in 478 in Google, and this is what will come up.
Right.
And the man is demonstrating it. But it's great. It's really very popular.
Mm.
So thank you so much for participating in the Pranayama exercise with Sevalad.
Yes.
And
yes,
namaste.
Yes.
Namaste. Have a good week, everybody.
Everyone have a good week, a prosperous week. Beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you, Featherlight. Thank you, Scotty. Thank you, listeners. And we want to thank our guest, Veronica P. Loving, author of Feeding the Monster.
And get out and do some earthing. Get out in nature and do some earthing.
Do some earthing.
Some
earthing, for sure. All right. So peace and good night. Namaste.
Thanks.